For some years, on visits to northern Michigan, I've driven by, and I'm sure you have too, you've driven by a billboard between Lansing and Clare promoting Cops and Donuts. This is a donut shop in Clare, the gateway to the north. I'm not proud to admit this, I've never visited Cops and Donuts, but I've driven by the billboard for years, and Emily Gerken-Garant today of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation tweets that MEDC is investing in downtown Clare with, apparently by investing some money in Cops and Donuts, historic Clare City Bakery since 1896. I doubt if it was called Cops and Donuts in 1896, but I've got to put that on my list of things to do this summer. Here is to finally make my first visit to Cops and Donuts in Clare. It's current state here on 90.5 WKAR. It's Monday. We're glad you're here with us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Professor Mark Edwards has become renowned as the leader of the Flint Water Team. That's a nearly 40-member group of civil engineering students and staff from Virginia Tech University. Its work first confirmed the health threat facing residents after the switch to Flint River water 2 years ago. As government on all levels continues working to make Flint water safe, the water team plays a central role analyzing the water. I spoke with Dr. Mark Edwards late on Friday. I first asked him about the community's response to the recent announcement by the EPA that filtered Flint water is again safe to drink, including by pregnant women and children.
How do you think people respond when all trust is lost? I think we're seeing it playing out. The filters have always been working very, very effectively to remove lead in water. And the federal agencies involved were erring on the side of caution. They wanted to get additional data to make sure that the filters were working effectively. And they've done that over the last several months. And the EPA's tested water from the very, very worst taps, and in every case, the filters are doing a great job of removing lead. So when this announcement was made, I guess I'm not surprised that many people in Flint, including some of my closest friends in Flint, are never going to be willing to believe that the filters are safe. So it's kind of a scary tale, actually, of when trust in government, when trust in science is lost, and even very, very good data showing that something is safe is not going to be trusted, and that's the case with filters in Flint right now.
Do you think that might change in the weeks or months to come?
I think it will for many residents. I mean, some, obviously, and with good reason, will never trust or drink tap water again. My good friend Leanne Walters is in that boat, as are many other Flint residents who are scared to take baths or showers. And I think we all understand how that could happen. But I think for the average Flint resident, that they see the state and the federal government are now trying their best to rectify the situation. And all the scientific data is clear that these filters work, and they work very effectively.
If it takes a lot of people a long time to resume drinking tap water, what impacts is that likely to have?
I don't think it's a huge impact. It's an inconvenience for them because they have to use bottled water. And, you know, it's probably actually safer and better for them to use the fresh water that's filtered right out of the tap than the bottled water that's been sitting in those plastic bottles now for many, many months. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, drinking water is not the major source of water in Flint. It's not a huge cost to pay for a few liters that you drink per person every day. And also in the context of flushing the system, it's not a big deal either. I mean, most of the flushing of water comes from washing dishes or bathing or showering or flushing toilets. So the real cost is just, you know, it's a shame the filters work and the residents are going through the inconvenience and of bottled water.
I assume you were at the heart of the process that led to the decision here. Remind us what threshold was passed that made filtered water drinkable again?
It really started out with just the National Sanitation Foundation had this threshold of 150 parts per billion, which they do their test at, and they're willing to rate their filters up to that level. And so anyone who makes a product, they want to make sure that it's not misused. At no point did NSF say that above 150 parts per billion, the filters would not work, especially in Flint, where a lot of the high lead results are particulate lead. They're little pieces of lead that you can easily filter out of the water. It's the soluble lead that's a little bit more challenging to filter. So even from the start, when we were getting very high lead levels, I knew based on our decade of experience that these would work. But if you're a federal agency or you're concerned about the safety of pregnant women and children, which we all are, and you see that they're only rated to 150 and you have brief moments in a in houses where it's above that level, it was wise to get additional test data just to make sure that for the specific circumstances in Flint, the filters would work. And it's taken a long time to get that data, and that data's come out the way I thought it would, which is the filters work even if the water occasionally has lead levels in the thousands of parts per billion. So it was really just confirming that the recommendations of the manufacturer, the set point at which they would rate and certify the filters, in practice, you could go well beyond that without any problem.
We're talking with Dr. Mark Edwards of the Flint Water Team at Virginia Tech. Last week, the State Department of Health and Human Services announced Genesee County's first case of Legionella here in 2016. Is your team responding to that in any way?
We have been working very intensively on the Legionella problem since we first predicted it would occur last summer. And when we found out that there were the two spikes that occurred in 2014-2015 and the deaths, that we've really been looking at this very intensively in collaboration with the state and the federal relief efforts. And, you know, I can tell you everyone is taking this very, very seriously. Earlier this summer, we made decisions that left no stone unturned in terms of trying to make sure that this Legionella outbreak, if it was tied to the water, and we all think it was, would not reoccur. So this has been addressed at every level. The flushing program that the state paid for, making sure chlorine levels are high, the recommended additional chlorine capabilities just in case it was needed, and those are being installed. And we were also on the ground last week in Flint looking at water heaters there just to make sure that things are as good as we think they are. And so far, so good.
The reports I've read suggest that health officials have never conclusively linked the Legionella outbreak in 2014 and into 2015 to the switch to Flint River water. Is that accurate? And is that something we'll ever learn the answer to?
Well, there's really no other plausible explanation on the table at this point, so it's as close to being certain as you can get without being certain. I think most scientists who've looked at the data and most health officials think there was definitely a connection. But it depends on the degree of certainty that you want to have. Is it 100%? No, not yet. But everyone is acting as if it was the cause, and we're making sure that to the extent we're able to, does not reoccur.
How do you assess the role that state agencies, the DEQ and the Department of Health and Services, how do you assess the roles that they are playing now in Flint?
I think since they did deserve a lot of criticism, obviously, for the 18-plus months that Flint residents were drinking this water, federal law was not being followed, and you had the damage to the head and the Legionella. But ever since they realized that flood lead of Flint children was rising, they have been doing a great job. And I would be the first to criticize them. I thought otherwise. But, you know, from the moment they saw that data, and I certainly will criticize their actions up to that point, they have been doing everything possible to protect Flint residents to try to get this them back on its feet.
What about EPA and other federal agencies?
Well, with the EPA, I'm of two minds, one of which is the normal people who are there day in and day out working with the city of Flint. They're doing a great job. They're doing everything that the EPA should do from, you know, so I can't say enough good about that. I am a little bit upset that the EPA has not taken their share of responsibility for this creating this mess in the first place, but that's a decision that's being made at an administrative higher level. And, you know, so on the one hand, they're doing a great job. And on the other hand, it's a little bit disappointing. And but that's the way it is.
What about the city of Flint? What kind of work do you think they're doing now?
They're doing great. You know, I mean, they're under capacity, and we have to build capacity in the city so that they can actually, you know, do the pipe replacements and make sure the water's safe and appropriately build people for water use. And, you know, all of these things are going to take time. But I can tell you, everyone at the table, and that includes the city, state, and the feds, they're doing their best, and they don't always agree on every single thing, but from my perspective, their heart has been in the right place, and everyone is working very, very hard on this issue.
Our guest is Dr. Mark Edwards of the Flint Water Team here on WKAR's Current State. Last month, after a lot of deliberation and disagreement, the city decided to go ahead with the plan involving the Carignandi Water Authority, which will mean Lake Huron water will be coming to Flint next year, as I understand it. Does a switch to yet another source of water concern you?
I don't think so, for two reasons. First, the EPA is going to make sure this time that the staff at the Flint plant are going to be able to treat this water. In addition, this water is much easier to treat, and it's the exact same water, essentially, that the Detroit is treating and sending to Flint. So there is really no change in the water at all from what they're currently getting, except they're going to have to treat it. And I think it's clear that, you know, the time that the water's come online is going to be delayed to make sure that all the resources and staff and training are in place to make sure it's done right.
Does your team's work have a particular focus right now?
We are working on both the possible Legionella issues in Flint, making sure that the system is being operated. We just completed a study of water heaters in Flint to see whether some kind of enhanced flushing of those heaters would be desirable to improve the safety and quality of the water, and we should know the results of that in the next couple of weeks. We are also coordinating with Flint residents again in the next few weeks to resample for the third time the houses that showed the widespread lead problem across the city. And we're hoping this time that the results are under federal law, but it is what it is, and it's going to take as long as it takes to get safe water back to Flint. We should know the results of that by about early August. So it'll be this week and next week they'll be distributing the bottles to resample those homes with high lead in Flint.
Flint's crisis led to more reporting and to a discussion of lead rules and infrastructure, really for the country. As the situation in Flint slowly improves, do you fear that urgency about lead and infrastructure might be lost?
Well, it's always a possibility, and I hope that doesn't occur. I mean, if after the fiasco in Flint, if that didn't expose what a joke the national lead and copper rule is and how people around the country are taking safe water for granted, sometimes with no good reason, I don't know what will. And as you've said, we've seen problems with lead in schools across the country. We've seen problems with lead in water and other utilities using cheats to hide lead in water problems. And it did spark this national conversation, and if this doesn't give rise to something that tries to get this fixed, and again, we're not even talking about a new law here. All we're talking about is following the existing law that we as a society passed and expected was in place to protect us from lead and water. But if we can't, you know, follow the old law and improve it so that our kids are protected, then, it's a sad day in America. But I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic that we're going to learn from this mistake and get some things fixed.
You and I last spoke in February. There have since been two sets of charges, one criminal, one civil, filed against individuals on one hand, the criminal charges, and engineering companies on the other. Those are the civil charges. I'm wondering if you're following those and if you have any thoughts about them.
I think that they've charged the core bad actors at the state who had the job of making sure the federal law was being followed and were working overtime to try to cover this problem up. That's based on my reading of the emails and my 12 years working on similar matters. So I think that, you know, this is where it goes, though. It's very hard to be successful in prosecuting criminal acts if they're conducted by civil servants. And we'll see how it all plays out.
We want to thank Dr. Mark Edwards, who heads the Flint Water Team at Virginia Tech, for his time here today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
And a reminder for current state listeners in Flint, remember the Empower Flint mobile app. You'll find the latest news and information on water safety, lead levels, and more. Download it on Android or your iPhone. The Empower Flint app from Michigan State University and WKAR, Mid-Michigan's NPR and PBS stations. And coming up on Current State, do you have a criminal history? In a growing list of Michigan cities, you no longer have to check yes or no about your criminal history when applying for a job. Current State's Brooke Allen takes a closer look with a Ferndale resident and attorney and the city's mayor, Dave Coulter. That's on the way. Usually by the time things make it to the scrapyard, people don't want them anymore, but that's not the case for the 17 teams of artists participating in Old Town's Scrap Fest this weekend. For the 8th year in a row, artists and welders and craftspeople from around Michigan will be taking scrap materials and turning them into art. They'll unveil their recycled and upcycled creations this weekend in Old Town Lansing. The event will also feature live music, family activities, a beer tent, an auction, and more. Here to tell us more about it is the executive director of the Old Town Commercial Association, Heather Mossing. Welcome, Heather.
Good morning.
And we want to welcome back Barbara Nilovich, a Scrap Fest committee member and a talented painter, sculptor, multimedia artist. Welcome, Barb.
Thank you.
And full disclosure, the Bay Shores are proud owners of an original Rinilovich.
Thank you again.
That we look at on a daily basis. We love it. Barb, whose brainstorm was Scrap Fest? A little history here.
Well, David Such of Such Media is an Old Town business owner, has been there since long before a lot of businesses were there. And he's a strong supporter of the arts, and he thought he always wanted to have an art event in Old Town. And he approached Friedland Industries, which owns one of the oldest businesses in Old Town.
Larry Bass, right?
Larry Bass, yeah, wonderful people. And they have become our staunch sponsors over the years and provide all the scrap material for these teams.
Mm. Heather, how does it work? Lay out the framework for us here.
Sure. So once we collect all the teams, they will come in on our collection day is what we call it, and they will collect up to 500 pounds of scrap metal, no more than that. If they collect more than 500 pounds, they have about 10 minutes to decrease it to 500 pounds. So it's pretty intense. After that,
This is a reality TV show waiting
great.
To happen.
You know, it's so exciting. It was my first time kind of being a part of the event this year all the way through, and it's very exciting waiting for everything to start happening from the minute they blow the horn to the last 10 minutes. But after they collect the scrap, they have 2 weeks to create some sort of masterpiece out of their scrap metal. They drop it off, and then at the event, we showcase all of their pieces. And I have to tell you, the pieces are amazing this year.
Yeah. And now, in terms of it, so the teams, the mm-hmm. artists themselves, mm-hmm. get to paw through all of the stuff and take what they want. So they're presumably getting ideas as they're looking over all the scrap.
Yes.
I take it?
Okay. Yep. And I think some artists come in with an idea, but I don't know how they do it from scrap to design.
Well, you never know what you're going to find.
That's right, exactly.
In a scrap heap.
Yeah, you have to be flexible.
How many teams? How many artists per team?
It varies. It can go from one to five, no more than five people on a team. There are a couple teams that only have one team member on them.
And all of it comes from Friedland?
Yep.
Okay, very right next to Proust Pets.
Yep, right next door.
In Old Town. What are some of the more common materials that the artists use in their creations? Do they pursue the weird and the oddly shapen pieces or what?
You see everything from refrigerators to die-cut materials. Very often they look for things that are weldable. So the steel, they want steel and they want iron. but they'll take aluminum, they'll take tin, and the shapes are just endless. And so you want large, simple shapes. You want some lightweight stuff, but you also want some heavy stuff so that its foundation is strong.
Yeah.
Because these are exterior sculptures, and they have to be movable, and they want to stand the test of time. If a person buys one on the auction, they want to know it's going to be a good piece that'll last.
From your perspective, Barb, do the artists, how many of the artists have an idea of what they want to create before they see the scrap?
I'd say it's about 50-50.
Oh, okay.
I ask them every year.
Okay. We're learning about this weekend's Scrap Fest in Old Town Lansing with Barb Ranilovich, an artist and member of the Scrap Fest committee, and Heather Mossing is the executive director of the Old Town Commercial Association. Tell us more about this year's creations. They've been at work on these things, and I take it you've had a chance to see them, Heather?
I have. We collected them probably almost a month ago now, and oh my goodness, there's some fish pieces, a couple abstract fish, one that you can actually tell that's a really cool fish jumping out of the water. There's people. There's a great sculpture that I think would be great for your garden. It's a man holding a wheelbarrow. It'd be beautiful with some flowers in it. All sorts of different pieces.
Have you looked them over yet,
oh,
Barb?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the range, we have also some very powerful pieces. They're heavy and dramatic. And there's whimsical. There's functional. We have garden seats. You know, we have one team that always does functional pieces. So there is really literally something for everybody.
How are the winners decided, Heather?
We have three judges that will come around, and they are awarded first through third place. They will receive a trophy for that, and then there's also the People's Choice Award that guests can vote on, so they can do that online or at the event.
How do they win anything?
They will get a trophy. I don't know that they get anything.
They get the
else.
Best trophies ever made because they're made by scrap artists.
Yes, so. That's true.
Perfect. Apropos.
And we have a raffle this year.
Yes.
What else is taking place as part of this
weekend? We have a
raffle,
I was just saying, for the first time because not everybody can afford to jump in on an auction and get a piece. So this year we're offering, Andrew Sandstedt has offered a piece and created a piece just for the raffle. So people can get, it's I think $20 a ticket. Mm-hmm. So they have a chance to get their own piece of scrap.
Live music.
Art. There will be live music, food vendors, children's activities. So a few different things for the family to come out and do.
What part does an event, how big a role does Scrap Fest play in Old Town? And what role do events like this, I mean, there is no other event like Scrap Fest, I think, but what role do events like this, broadly like this, play in Old Town's vitalization?
Absolutely. So an event like this, it's one of our few free events that we have. We have a couple other major festivals that we do charge admission for, and those events help us put on events like Scrap Fest. So this event allows us to bring down families, anyone and everyone can come down since it is a free event, and bring down people to the Old Town community and check things out.
Tell us a little bit more about the bands and the family activities here. What else is going on the fringes here?
Sure. So Friday night, we actually have a DJ that will come in for the night. And actually right after about 10 o'clock, the event ends on Friday night, and we'll actually have Turner Street Outdoor Theater. I believe we're playing the Mighty Ducks on Friday night, so that's another kind of piece of Scrap Fest, a family portion of it. And then on Saturday, we have about four or five bands lined up throughout the day from noon to about 7:30, which then the auction will start at 7:45. And we have three great food vendors, Michigan Pops, Mark's Gourmet Dogs, and Shimmy Shack.
Barb, you must know some number of these creators here. Mm-hmm. Tell us about a few of them.
I think Scrap Fest artists are the best people I've ever met. They are so upbeat and so energetic and so creative. And you see tattoos and you see piercings and you see very conservative people. It's a little of everything. And they just have this sense of adventure. They come back because it is so much fun.
Have you ever had
no,
taken
I'm
a
on
hand
the committee.
At this? Oh, okay.
No, but I make little ones. We make baubles that we sell. They're like little $10 magnets and things. And so a team of us get together and we make those. So it's like miniature scrap.
I would kill to have you on my team. I mean, you should drop off. You should drop off the committee just 1 year just so you can get involved.
Thinking about it.
Well, now the pieces will be auctioned off. How much do they have to go? How much have they gone for in the past?
Gosh, I think last year I want to say they went up just over $4,000 for one of the pieces. Mm. I think that's probably the highest they've ever
Absolutely.
Gone, but I think they range anywhere from $500 on up.
And the money goes to what?
50% will go to the Old Town Commercial Association, which goes towards the revitalization and historic preservation of Old Town. So that allows us to hang up flower baskets every year, remove the trash, put on free festivals like this one, and then the other 50% will go back towards the artists who worked so hard on their pieces to make this happen.
This has a cable TV TV special.
Let's
written
do it.
All over it.
I swear.
I can just see this on channel 193, you know, along this. Remind us of the location and the time of the festivities, Heather.
Absolutely. Friday, July 15th, the event will run from 6 to 10 p.m. on Turner Street down in Old Town Lansing. And then Saturday is from noon to 10 p.m. also on Turner Street.
Scrap Fest is the event we're talking about here with artist Barbara Nilovich, a Scrap Fest committee member, talented multimedia artist, along with Heather Mossing of the Old Town Commercial Association. Barb, what are you at work on right now? Talk to us.
Personally?
About, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You're
so well-known around town.
You're such a sweet pea. I'm busy making clay pieces right now. I'm taking classes in clay, and I'm working on – I did three Raku firings yesterday, and I'm filling some orders for galleries for various clay pieces,
Okay. Actually. And Heather, remind us what else is happening between now – I hesitate to say it, but we're almost halfway through the summer or thereabouts. It's amazing how quickly the summer passes by. What else is on the calendar at Old Town here that really people should know about?
Absolutely. So after Scrap Fest, actually next weekend, July 24th, Sunday, we have our first garden tour in Old Town. So there are 11 gardens throughout Old Town that we'll be showcasing something new. You can check that out at oldtownevents.org. And then we also have Art Feast coming up in August, on August 20th, where we showcase up to about 40 artists, vendors this year, right on Turner Street, and we'll have about 9 food trucks down there. So
fantastic.
Definitely don't want to miss out on those.
Very good. We want to thank Heather Mossing is Executive Director of the Old Town Commercial Association. Also a big thanks to Barbara Nilovich, an artist and a member of the Scrap Fest Committee. Scrap Fest is coming up this weekend. Heather, Barb, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, did you know that America's first paved road was in Detroit? Current State Scott Pohl visits the site along Woodward Avenue with the president of the Michigan Historical Commission, Jack Dempsey. That and more after the break on Current State. Imagine for a second making a contribution that leaves a legacy to WKAR for generations to come. Well, a donation into an endowment will create that long-term support and lasting impact. Learn more at WKAR.org. And a big thank you to everyone who participates or contributes to an endowment here at WKAR. That contribution, those endowments, get an awful lot of important work done. It's Current State here on WKAR. Should someone who has served time for a criminal offense be obligated to tell a prospective employer about their criminal history, even if it doesn't pertain to the job they're applying for? Nationwide, there are over 100 cities and counties that have decided to ban the box, removing questions about criminal history from job applications. Today, the city of Ferndale joins a growing list of Michigan cities adopting a ban the box policy. Current State's Brooke Allen spoke with several people involved in the effort to ban the box, including Ferndale Mayor Dave Coulter and Attorney Vince Colella. First, we hear from Monica Janer, a woman who struggled with checking the box.
I was incarcerated for 28 years and came home in 2007.
How was that for you to look for a job?
I have a bachelor's degree in behavioral science. I got an associate's degree in criminal justice, and I'm also a paralegal. So I had plenty of experience when I came home, and I really wanted to work with kids. I had been in prison where we had 13, 14, and 15-year-old girls coming to prison doing life sentences, and I just could not understand why we were sending our kids to prison, you know, and waiving them as adults when they're clearly not mentally adults. So when I came home, my plan was to work with juveniles and help and work with kids. So I applied for a job at one of the detention centers. And, of course, I never heard back from him. And it dawned on me, okay, I have to hit this box that says you've been convicted of a felony, and nobody kept calling me back. What really frustrated me was that there was nobody with more experience to help kids than myself. You know, I went to prison at a very young age, and I could help kids, and I did help kids while I was incarcerated. So I really thought my experience would help these kids if I could get into some of those facilities. But no, people didn't see it that way. You've been convicted of a felony, and we're just not going to give you those opportunities to help these kids.
No matter your experience.
No matter at my experience, you know. So, yeah, I created a mentoring program inside prison for the 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old juveniles. So, yeah, who better to come out and try to take those experiences and try to help the kids that are, you know, up and coming into the system?
So it just didn't matter.
Once I told them I was a felon, it was done. There was no more conversation.
Did anyone ever ask you, what was your crime, and did it even ever get that far for
they
you?
They never, and wouldn't even give me an opportunity to come in and sell myself. That's why I'm such a big advocate for the ban in the box. Just give me the opportunity to come in and sell myself and tell you where I've been, what I've done, how I got to where I am, and my experience that would be, you know, they're the people that were going to suffer by not hiring me, because I can bring this experience to that table.
So under the box that you have to check, if there had ever been, or maybe there is, I don't know, like an explanation that you could, you know, if you have to check it,
exactly.
Is there something that you can say, can I explain? Or is there a line to say other that you can write in? Or is it just simply check the box and that's just
it? That's it. Yeah, it just checked the box. There wasn't a thing that says, tell me your story. You know, that's why I want the box off, so I can get in, tell my story, and let you see exactly what I've done and see that I would be an asset to your corporation or your business or your mentoring program. You know, so yeah, I didn't get that opportunity, and that frustrated me.
So that was in 2007?
That was in 2007, 2008, and I was very connected inside while I was incarcerated. I did prison legal services. I was a representative for the women that were in the court case of Kane versus the MDOC, so I came up to Lansing a couple days a week to represent the people. So I was extremely connected to a lot of attorneys. So when I came home, I knew a lot of different people, the CAPS, who's the Citizens Alliance on Prison and Public Spending, which is driving all the legislation right now. I was connected to them. So everybody wanted me to get involved in the criminal justice system. And, you know, first I wanted to take a little vacation, but it didn't work that way. So I went to somebody asked me to sit on a board, and it was a board called ARROW, which is Advocacy, Reentry, Resource, and Outreach. It was a newly formed organization, and they were starting a reentry program. So everybody kept saying, Monica, go down there. You could do this with your hands tied behind your back. So I went to go get on the board, and there was a job opening. So I said, okay, let me go ahead and try this. I had no desire to do reentry work, but when I, you know, okay, they're going to hire me, because part of the stipulation was it was a Morehouse grant from Alabama or Atlanta, and they had to hire a felon for the position, so I was a token for the job.
So in a sense, they had to give it to you almost.
They had to give it to me because I was the felon with the most qualifications in that area, so that's how I got to this position. So the more I came into this, the more I saw that it was the community and the public and the people that were closing the doors on getting felons jobs. It was really frustrating.
But a handful of Michigan communities like Ferndale are trying to reopen that door. Ferndale Mayor David Coulter says a job applicant's voluntary disclosure of their past criminal history should not translate into an automatic rejection. You're looking at someone to hire them for a job, and they come to you, and the box is no longer there, so you can't ask anything. And somebody says to you, look, I have something to tell you. I was in prison, and they tell you straight off the bat. What do you do with that at that point?
What I hope the interview team would do is consider that along with all the other factors related to that candidate. I mean, if they're looking for a job in the Treasury Department and they have an embezzlement on their record, you know what? That's going to be considered. And obviously that would be considered differently than if when you were 21, you stole something from the corner store. So it really, what it forces you to do is look at the offense and see how it relates to this person, where they are today, and the job that they're applying for. And if it's relevant to it, then of course you're going to consider it. And frankly, I think it would speak to that person's integrity for sharing that. But if it's not relevant, then maybe we can get past that kind of stigma that those people carry around with them for having that on their record.
Vince Colella is a trial attorney and a civil rights expert, and while he says that an employer should not discriminate against a job candidate if they have checked the box, the employer is still within their rights to ask the prospect about any past criminal history during the interview.
The fact of the matter is, if that question is on an application, the likelihood of them getting a fresh start or an opportunity to be employed is significantly reduced. And so the whole idea here is that while we're trying to protect the employer from hiring convicts or felons who have the propensity for committing a crime that's specific to that job, we don't want to exclude everybody.
Are there any downsides to this?
I think that there are two arguments for keeping the box on an application. The first, of course, is to protect the employer from liability. For example, if you are a bar owner, you wouldn't want to hire a bouncer who has a violent felony on their record. If I, as a personal injury lawyer, are investigating a case where a bouncer, assaulted a patron, and I got the application and I see that there was a felony conviction on the application, I would certainly be more apt to say, well, this employer probably negligently hired this individual. So it's a blanket way of protecting the employer from any liability. But really, I think the arguments that are being made nationwide is that it's cost savings, that the interview process in and of itself is expensive. And if we can eliminate candidates that we are simply not going to hire because they have a conviction on their record, we don't have to bring them in. We don't have to vet them through a criminal background check, all of the resources necessary to do that. So there is some cost savings, I think. An argument could be made, I should say, for cost savings and potentially liability.
Ferndale now joins three other Michigan cities, Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Kalamazoo, in banning the box.
So I expect that the ordinance will be formally adopted this evening, and then that will be the official policy of Ferndale going forward.
There's also a statewide push to ban the box, and Monica Janer is helping lead that effort. How many people do you think, or how many people do you know personally, have lost out on jobs who are qualified, who would be excellent workers because of that box?
Oh, I couldn't even count in numbers, but let me tell you, I help people get jobs. That's what I do for a living now, is in reentry and diversion. So the guys go in, they might get a temporary employment job at General Motors or one of the corporations, them or one of the different corporations up here. And through the agency, they can work for 6 months. But as soon as they're done with the agency, the corporation comes and says, we can't hire you because you're a felon. But they did a great job for 6 months. I mean, tell me how does that work? And there's nothing on the job that they could do. They're driving a forklift or they're putting parts on a car. What kind of crime could they commit while they were on the job? But they worked for 6 months. They did an excellent job. No problems, no nothing, but they can't get the job because they have a felony.
I'm almost speechless.
Yeah, I absolutely, So, yeah, my guys come in and this keeps happening to them over and over and over again.
So tell me what you're doing right now to get this box banned.
Well, I'm working with Representative Durhall out of Detroit, actually, and we've put in House Bill 4366 for the to take the box off the job application throughout the state. So that's our first step, that trying to do that will be with the state jobs. And then we hope to go with the private, the people that own their own businesses. All we want to do is give them the opportunity to get in the door.
Well, thank you so much, Monica, for joining me and for telling us about your experience.
No problem. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Brooke Allen.
And I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Every summer, Scott Pohl visits historic sites in Detroit with Jack Dempsey. Jack's the president of the Michigan Historical Commission. For their first talk this summer, Jack takes Scott to a spot along Woodward Avenue to talk about a development that forever changed the way we drive. For the first time in this country, this site in Detroit was the location of a stretch of road made of concrete.
Jack Dempsey, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are standing in Palmer Park, adjacent to Woodward Avenue in Detroit, and it's my understanding that we chose this locale because this stretch of Woodward was the first paved road in America. correct?
There's a historical marker here put up by the state of Michigan years ago, commemorating that this is the first mile of concrete highway in the U.S., yes.
When did this happen?
In 1909, Wayne County built this one-mile stretch of concrete on Woodward Avenue between 6 Mile Road and 7 Mile Road. It cost the grand sum of $13,537.
We were just counting the lanes, and I believe it was something like 6 lanes on each side. I'll bet that first incarnation of this paved road was not 6 lanes in each direction.
Probably replaced a horse-drawn lane of some sort, yes.
What were roads like prior to that? You hear talk from time to time of not just unpaved roads, but things like planking being used on roads, that sort of thing. How much do we know about that in this area?
Plank roads actually go way back to the 18th century. In fact, there's a stretch of plank road that still exists down along the Lake Erie shoreline that's part of the River Raisin National Battlefield called Hull's Trace, the military road between Toledo and Detroit. So corduroy roads where you would fell trees, chop them into logs or planks and lay them down go way back, and actually were in use as late as the turn of the 20th century when automobiles really came into their fore.
Well, 1909, Detroit is, you might say, in the infancy of becoming the Motor City. Maybe it shouldn't come as a surprise that this would be the first place where this was tried.
I think as the auto manufacturers began to grow and people began to buy more vehicles, they started clamoring, both of those interest groups, for better roads, not muddy roads, not roads that had essentially a corduroy feel to them, but smoother roads that would be longer lasting. Ironically, this first stretch only lasted for about 13 years, but it was because of the growing usage of motor vehicles such that the road had to be expanded, made larger to accommodate traffic.
Well, along with that became the evolution of the traffic light system that we know today, and a lot of that history is also right here in the Detroit area.
Yes, the first four-way, three-color traffic light was installed, debuted here in the Detroit area at Michigan Avenue and Woodward, so several miles to the southeast of us.
The evolution of the traffic light is also interesting. At first, there were just two lights in each direction, and there was a Michigan connection to developing the three-light system that we use today, too.
Yes, a Detroit police officer, who later became known as Mr. Traffic Light, developed this idea to have not just a red and a green light, but to have a yellow or amber light to tell approaching motorists that the light was going to change so that you better slow down and be ready to stop. So that was invented here in Detroit. And Mr. Traffic Light actually ended up working for what's now today AAA Michigan, the Auto Club of Michigan, and was further in the business of trying to design more safety features for Michigan motorists.
So the traffic light system, as we know it today, started to evolve around 1918. But one of the developments prior to that that also has Michigan ties is the center line, which we tend to think of, I suppose, as common sense. I gather that there wasn't a center line prior to that.
In 1911, again, the Wayne County officials did install or create the first painted center line along River Road, which was in the community of Trenton. So I guess as we think of how people were getting used to using motor vehicles and figuring out how they would work, sometimes they would stray across the middle of the road, and putting that painted line down the middle helped keep them honest.
Another reason to have paved roads. You couldn't paint a line down the middle of a dirt road.
That's correct. Unfortunately, with every advance comes some downside, and as we see in Michigan today, all of the concrete roads or the asphalt roads also bring with them the need for maintenance. Not that a dirt road doesn't, but it's a different type of maintenance, and so it's, I think, probably more costly today to have all the roads we have than otherwise if they were still in the condition they were in, say, 1909 or so.
So this first stretch of paved road in Detroit cost something on the order of $13,000 in 1909. That sort of expense has certainly come a long way. You might not even fill a pothole for $13,000 today.
I think that's absolutely true. And it is a challenge for us today as a state and as taxpayers that we have to maintain this road system. And we've been struggling with that of late after the Great Recession. And hopefully things will improve, continue to improve.
Now, for people who might have an interest in stopping by to see this marker along Woodward, again, as I mentioned, we're standing in Palmer Park. There's an interesting history here at Palmer Park, too, not just the park itself, but the surrounding residential area. Tell me about Palmer Park, Jack.
It was a very prestigious neighborhood back in Detroit's heyday, and the houses that border the park are still quite magnificent. And the neighborhood's really got a lot of notable Detroiters that live here, that used to live here. Palmer, named for a very famous Detroiter. And so it's quite an interesting location right off of M1 Woodward, and with a lot of trees still here. Perhaps we don't think of Detroit being very tree-filled today, but this park is very beautiful and certainly worth a visit. The marker is right on Woodward, so you'd have to find a parking spot in a nearby lot or a parking area as this car pulls up.
The marker's over there.
And the marker itself, I suppose, is a bit representative of the state of today's roads in Michigan. It's got a lot of wear and tear on it and probably needs itself to have some rehabilitation.
We're talking with Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission, and on the subject of historical markers, I know you are a lover of visiting historical markers and making sure that they're paid attention to, visited, maintained. What's the current status of the system for installing new markers, I suppose, but also maintaining the presence of the ones that we already have?
The markers themselves really are a function of some individual or group who raises the money to obtain the marker and have it installed. It is state property. It's a program that has existed since 1955. Initially, the legislature appropriated some money to launch the program and to fund markers. But by and large, today it is a privately funded program, which the state supports, but probably could do more to support in terms of educating people on how to maintain them, rehabilitate them, aiding in replacing them if they need replacement, as this marker definitely needs either rehabilitation or replacement.
What's the role of the commission?
The Michigan Historical Commission works with the Department of Natural Resources and the Michigan History Center to approve markers, to make sure the history behind them is properly vetted, and then we work to make sure they go in the right location, attend the dedication, and really help the community to launch it. After the marker is installed, it really, personally, I believe it's up to the community to try to always pay attention to the condition of their markers. The state will work with them in terms of how to maintain them and care for them, or potentially to have them replaced. So it's really a matter of community pride for each marker, of which we today have more than 1,700 across Michigan, some in great shape, those that have been installed recently. And we generally, I think, approve somewhere on the order of 20 or so every year. So the program continues to grow.
Jack Dempsey is president of the Michigan Historical Commission. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Scott.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
By the way, Scott and Jack Dempsey discussed Mr. Traffic Light during that conversation, but his name was omitted. We'll make that good here. Mr. Traffic Light was former Detroit police officer William Potts. That's our program for today, looking at Tuesday's Current State. A proposal at the state capitol would create a new kind of dental professional here in Michigan, the dental therapist. It would be roughly equivalent to a physician's assistant in a doctor's office. We'll talk with the sponsor, Republican State Senator Mike Shirkey, about the measure and about opposition to it as well in our Tuesday environmental segment, we'll learn more about the mission of the Environmental Law and Policy Center. It describes itself as the Midwest's leading public interest environmental legal advocacy and eco-business innovation organization. The Environmental Law and Policy Center. More on that organization tomorrow here on Current State. Peter Whorf is the executive producer of this program. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Brooke Allen, Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable, with a lot about what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get great podcasts. Stay connected with Current State on Twitter. Follow us at KAR Current State and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. Have a great day. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on 90.5.